This week on Two Dudes and Tunes, we dive into a magical period of my musical growth, and today's artist was my baptism into mutant blues. While preparing for this week's episode, I learned about the Antwerp Diamond Heist, a $100 million heist. You should definitely Google it. And Netflix, if you're listening, you need to make a documentary about it. It is awesome. The US government invaded Iraq on the threat of WMDs, thanks W, and topped Saddam Hussein's regime that year. Closer to home, today's band was rocking their way into the national lexicon from their garage in Detroit with their fourth studio album, which only further made us ask, are they brother, sister, or husband, wife? And does Michigan allow for them to be both legally? If you haven't guessed it yet, I'm talking about Jack and Meg White, the White Stripes, and their 2003 album, Elephant, today on Two Dudes and Tunes. Hey there, dudes and dudettes. My name is Wood. I am the co-host of this show, joined as always with my good friend, Chris Robinson. Chris, how's it going today, man?
Oh, boy. It has been a whirlwind this week. It feels like we just did the episode for Sound and Color last week.
Mm-hmm.
Like I woke up this morning, I was like, man, it's already Thursday. But this week has kind of gone by, like I said, it's gone by in a blur, cause I had practice Tuesday for Justin and I's show this Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
We had to stop by the bank and sign some papers on Wednesday. And then I had also, there's a good friend of mine from college that I'm trying to like keep in better contact with. And we sit down and talk on the phone every second Tuesday of the month.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he called me in the middle of practice on Tuesday. I was like, oh, no, I'm a terrible friend. So
what have we done?
Great. Now I have guilt.
We rescheduled for Wednesday. So I sat down and chatted with him Wednesday. And then today we've got the podcast. And I don't know what happened Monday. Monday was a blur. But anyway, it's just all gone by super quickly, which is kind of nice. It's nice when the work week comes to an end quickly. How about you? How's your week been?
It has been a rough week for me at work. For those of you who haven't caught on, I manage fleet vehicles for a career, a paycheck, if you will. And I woke up on Monday to 47 trucks at one parking location having their catalytic converters stolen from them. And so far this week total, I've had about 120 trucks have their cats stolen. Which is just a nightmare to deal with. The parts are on back order. People who drive the trucks are upset, you know, of course, and there's nothing I can really do about it. So it's been an interesting week of getting yelled at just constantly from all angles and wanting to be able to say, what do you want me to do? What do you expect me to do?
Did you, I'm assuming you didn't steal the catalytic converters. Why are they mad at you?
No, it's awesome. The crooks will like cut a hole in our chain link fences with Sawzalls, and then they'll cut off the catalytic converters from underneath like our really big $150,000 trucks that are up high enough that they don't need to like crawl under them even.
Oh,
they'll cut them off,
see.
And then as kind of like a antagonizing little push, they'll break their equipment, their tools, and they'll leave them in piles in the middle of our parking location like a sacrificial altar.
Oh, man.
And it causes
their calling card.
Kind of, yeah. But the tools aren't even good anymore. Like, we can't even use them for something. They're broken.
That is frustrating.
It just kind of sucks. But one of the things that I did have a lot of fun with this week, though, in the intro, I mentioned that Antwerp diamond heist. And I seriously, instead of preparing for this episode, ended up reading about this thing for hours this week. It is a real Ocean's 11 type tactic. Diamond heist. It took them 18 months of planning. They rented a storefront in a big diamond block of Antwerp and had proposed as like diamond merchants and got all this inside experience with all these other true diamond vendors and then ripped them all off and ran away. And some people went to jail for it, but the majority of the $100 million in diamonds and gold has never been recovered. So,
oh, man.
It's just this.
I want to know.
It's so awesome.
I need to check that out. I need to do some reading. I want to know who's got that money.
Yeah, or where it's buried. Like, where is it?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, man, I would love to dig that up.
And then the other kind of bright spot in the week, a couple of years ago was when I kind of got into podcasting and listening to podcasts. And back then, what got me into it was a guy named Tim Hawkins, who had a podcast called Potty Break, P-O-D-D-Y-B-R-E-A-K. Fantastic. And it was, he's a, like a family-friendly, clean comedian. He plays lots of churches and he does like parody music. And I've threatened you a couple of times that we need to do one of his albums on this podcast. Cause he's
bring it on.
He's actually a really entertaining musician and he's got funny lyrics.
Yeah, he's funny.
But thank you, Chick-fil-A, for the sponsorship. His Potty Break podcast was him on his tour bus with like all the people from his tour just talking on headsets while the bus was driving down the road. So it was just them goofing around. And that podcast ended about a year and a half ago before COVID. And there was no announcement. It just stopped. And he stopped producing podcasts. And it was just a bummer. Well, last week, the feed went live again, and it's a new show with him and his family kind of sitting around kind of doing the same thing, but it's them in their living room. And his kids are like your age and my age, roughly. And it's just funny to hear them kind of bantering back and forth and making fun of stuff. But his favorite thing to make fun of is country music. So I think you'd really like his kind of his shtick. They play clips from songs like the 8-count boom. Like every country song currently has, you know, an 8 counts and then there's a big boom in the music of some kind. Or in this in this week's episode, he spent most of it making fun of Brad Paisley's nonsensical guitar solos, playing them and just ripping on him. Like Brad Paisley's a phenomenal guitar player, but a terrible soloist.
You better watch it, buddy. No, he's a fantastic soloist. He's really good.
Listen to his episode and see.
I need to see what his take is because Brad Paisley is, he's fantastic.
His take is a good guitar solo is something you can sing with your mouth and like Hotel California or any of those. And Brad Paisley's over there just laying so many layers on top of it that it's basically how many strings can I bend at once?
You know, the kind that are just way up high on the tiny strings and you mash your fingers on
to
them.
To get something out of it. And it's amazing, but it follows no musical structure. Mm. It works.
I'm going to pick a fight with Tim Hawkins. If only because I really enjoy Brad Paisley's guitar play. But that has nothing to do with what you're talking about.
And what's also funny, what I love about his show is his daughter is on most of the episodes. And on the first two that they've done with this new platform or new program, she is just brutal at tearing him down. Like he says something stupid and she's like on top of it. Like
it's funny.
So great.
It's those that love you that can hurt you the most.
Yes, exactly. Well, and he takes it like he's really funny in his responses back, but it is one of the most brutal, just, wow, that's some candor.
That's funny. I love it. I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. So what? Definitely worth listening to and entertaining.
Yeah.
You got anything else for small talk before we dive into this week's episode?
I do, actually. So Tuesday, was it Tuesday or Wednesday? I don't remember. The day of the week is unimportant to the story. I show up to work and I'm a little bit of a morning person. I enjoy the routine of getting up and making coffee and breakfast and just kind of relaxing. So my enthusiasm for work begins at the beginning of the workday and ends about as soon as like we hit double digits in the hours of the morning. I'm like ready to be going.
It was like 5 minutes after the time clock got stamped.
No. Actually, a tangent on top of a tangent, hat on top of a hat. We got fingerprint scanners like for clocking in pretty much as soon as COVID hit. So that was terrible timing because I have coworkers
touch this who will with your grimy fingers.
I watched most of my coworkers lick their fingers to get the Cheeto dust somehow. I guess. But anyway, I showed up and I'm like in a good mood. I'm listening to music. And one of the guys from the front office walks up and he's walking with somebody that I don't know. And you can just kind of tell the difference between like the new guy at work and a customer that someone is showing around. Mm-hmm. And this was a new guy at work. And I'm responsible for training the new guys. And so my heart sank because what this means is I have to have this person shadowing me and, you know, doing
you
all
can't
the things.
Break the rules and listen to music at work when you've got a trainee.
I tell them only have one earbud in
because that's OSHA approved.
It's closer to the spirit of the OSHA rules than the letter for sure. But so anyway, I'm training this guy and I'm showing him how to tie up the trim that we have, how to, you know, where everything is, all this. And he seems like he's getting it. I was like, okay, this is pretty great. Well, we have a couple of paid breaks. We have a paid break at 10 a.m. and a paid break at 3 p.m. Mm-hmm. And so 10 a.m. rolls around and I tell them, all right, we can take break and then we'll get after it after break. And so I sit down and take my break and I'm like scrolling through Facebook or whatever. And my alarm goes off that tells me it's time to like get up and go back to work and do something. And I look around and he's not in the break room. And so I get out and I wander around one of our buildings. He's not in there. And I think, okay, well, maybe he's in the restroom. Neither of the restrooms are occupied. And I wander through the rest of our buildings and go and look in the parking lot and his car is gone.
What?
He just up and skipped town. Like, so our workday starts at 10:30. So 7:30. So 7:30 to 10:30 is what, like 2.5 hours? Yeah, three and a half hours. Yeah. I don't do a ton of math. But yeah, he just up and left. And so on the one hand, I was glad not to have a trainee to have to work on like shaping into somebody I can tolerate being around at work.
Because you can definitely train people to be tolerable.
You can try, and they pay me to try, so darn it, I'm going to try. But yeah, this guy just like skipped down, just ran off.
Did he ever show up for his 3 hours of pay?
No, that he's going to have to talk to the temp agency for that.
I remember probably my first week on the job with my current employer. I was a technician, and I came into work, and the guy who was supposedly training me got busted for hotboxing in the company vehicle.
Oh, what a classy fella.
Oh, it was awesome. So, like, I went from having a trainer to having no trainer. Like, all right, you get the truck and clean it out and get busy.
Oh, like, man, that's by so myself. Funny. You're supposed to hotbox before work in your own car.
Exactly.
That's the protocol. Come on. This guy's operating Bush League. That's ridiculous.
Hey, he got away with it for a lot of years, apparently. It was the final straw.
Yeah, that must have been. That was the one time he didn't get away with it, and that was the true problem.
There you have it. Well, hey, man, I think it's time we finally start talking about Elephant. You ready?
Yeah, let's discuss the elephant in the room.
The White Stripes Elephant, April 1st, 2003. Did you think this album was an April Fool's joke when it came up last week?
I didn't, but I did think that that was definitely on purpose. Like, I'm sure that Jack White thought to himself, like, I'm so funny and clever releasing an album on April 1st. Look at me go.
So what was your first experience with this album, Chris? Because I know both of us were musically awake when this one came out.
Yeah, so I don't really have like a definitive starting point for the White Stripes, because I never listened to him that much. The first I kind of heard Jack White's guitar playing was the band The Raconteurs. Because I had seen the video for whatever, On the Level, that's what it was called. It was called On the Level. The music video for that was just the band standing in some warehouse playing the song. And I really liked Jack White's guitar playing. But I never, other than Seven Nation Army, like, they were just like a non-entity for me. And even like somehow I missed all of their albums and went straight to like Jack White's solo work. So I had never really sat down and listened to a White Stripes album. Maybe I had probably heard Icky Thump on the radio. And maybe like listened to a couple tracks off that album. But this was my first experience with them, which it's kind of weird to me because Jack White's stuff all kind of sounds very similar. So even though I hadn't sat down and listened to the White Stripes, I kind of knew what I was in for. But what was your, because you put this on your list, so obviously this is something that you had experience with when it came out. Is it, did you hear it in 2003?
So I did, and I'm trying to remember how this album came into my life personally. I'm 90% sure this is something that my younger brother, Britton, who's a year younger than me, purchased on CD to go on a particular road trip that we had in 2003. So in about June or July of 2003, so shortly after this album came out, my homeschool family loaded up into our homeschool conversion van and drove from San Antonio, Texas to Oklahoma City for the homeschool national basketball tournament.
That is fantastic.
And you want to talk about a city being taken over by like no fewer than 200 homeschool basketball teams. Like these vans were everywhere. You knew where basketball games were being played by gyms with just hundreds of these vans parked at them.
That's amazing.
Everybody was in a conversion van. But it was on that road trip, I distinctly remember us listening because there was a CD player and like a TV in the back of this van that would entertain us for hours on end while we were driving cross country, either back and forth to Reno, Nevada, where my mom's family was and where my parents actually met, or to my grandparents' place up there in Brownfield, Texas. We commuted all over the country in one of these vans. And so there was like a shared DVD and CD player in that van, and we all had wireless headphones that would feed into it. And so we all had to listen to the same music. Nobody had iPods.
Interesting.
And so that album was something that got put in the rotation. And I'm sure Third Rock from the Sun was one of the albums, because that album just rocked around inside that back of that van for forever.
Yeah.
And so at some point, Elephant got put into the player, and the three of us were sitting in the back listening to it, and it was just kind of like a light bulb moment for myself. I was 15 at the time. My brother was 14. And then my youngest brother, Steve, was 12. And so we were all just kind of mesmerized by it, start to finish. And at some point in time, my parents put on headsets, and then we ended up listening to it without the headsets on the actual sound system of the van. My parents loved that van because the kids could listen to music loud and they didn't have to hear any of it. We'd sit there quietly. Yeah.
I can imagine that was a great gift.
It was
to your parents.
To use a Chris line, it was a chef's kiss of perfection.
That's awesome. I bet my parents wish they had some sort of like shared headphone system that they could have put us on.
So it's funny. My parents listened to the album and they didn't like hate it. Like they enjoyed it, I guess, you know, they listened to it a couple of times on that road trip. But I distinctly remember it was either that year or later, the next year, that the White Stripes performed at the Grammys, like the opening number for the Grammys, and they did Seven Nation Army. And my mom had somehow like conflated Jack White with Jack Black.
Completely understandable. In fact, listeners, if you hear me say Jack Black, just switch that this episode with Jack White, because that's what I meant to say.
Hey, he was in School of Rock, one of the greatest movies ever made. And numerous other Nacho Libre. Like, if we don't have a Nacho Libre drop in this episode, I'm going to cry.
Oh, we can put one in right now.
Those guys were a couple of wussies, huh?
Okay.
So, but my mom's like surprise and utter dismay that, you know, that's not Jack Black. Like, no, mom, this is amazing. Jack White. Was probably one of the funniest moments of my early teenage years.
Excellent. That cracks me up. That's so good.
But anyhow, so that's kind of my first experience with the White Stripes. I really wasn't a fan of their earlier work because I wasn't aware of it. Like, this was the moment that I became aware of who the White Stripes were. And as the years have progressed, I've kind of moved on past it. And when we were creating our lists, I was kind of going through the albums that I remember having the greatest memories of. And that was one of those albums that made the top 15 easily. Just, oh, I remember when this showed up, and I'm sure it was Britton who bought it, and it was, I'm sure it was him who put it into the player, and the first time listening to it, we all had to like suffer through it or whatever, but by the end I was in love. So
awesome.
But anyhow, let's talk a little bit about the background of the album and a little bit about the Whites as people and kind of where they came from and whence they came, kind of thing.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
So Jack White was raised Catholic, and both of his parents worked for the Archdiocese of Detroit. So hyper-religious family. And he was accepted into seminary for high school. And he bailed out on it because it was like boarding school, and he didn't think they would let him take his new guitar amplifier.
Smart man. That was the right choice. If they're not going to let you bring your guitar and your amp, well, you don't need to be at that school.
He admits he never asked. He just didn't think they would let him.
So he just,
you know, he ended up going to a public school for high school and played, I believe it was trombone and drums in the band.
Nice.
But he picked up musical instruments from his brothers, who they were playing music, doing the whole music thing. And whenever they got bored of an instrument, he'd end up playing it. So he started playing drums when he was in the first grade on a discarded drum set in his parents' attic.
That's amazing. I love it. That's the best musicians, I feel like, come from that. You know, I feel like most drummers that I talk to learn to play on pots and pans, and it becomes so intolerable that their parents are like, well, if I have to listen to this, it might as well be real instruments instead of, you know, cookware and
get them
spoons.
Some Zildjians, please.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, so his early musical influences, not to cut you off, were blues artists. Uh-huh. And so he was a big fan of classic rock and blues music. And sometime while he was in high school, I couldn't quite figure out what year, he entered into a 3-year upholstery apprenticeship with a friend of his dad's.
That's what I was going to bring up, is because the one thing I know about him is that he worked as an upholsterer. For a few years. And I don't know why that's like particularly perfect, but it really seems to suit his like rough and tumble aesthetic.
Well, and the idea that it was an apprenticeship, like he didn't go to school, he went to work as an apprentice for 3 years. And then once he completed that apprenticeship, he owned a one-man upholstery company that worked out of like a yellow van. That he called
so shady.
He called it Third Man Upholstery, which is interesting because his record label is Third Man Records. So that's kind of been, and he's the third son of his family.
Oh,
so I think that's the tie in there. But
yeah, there you go.
He's quoted as saying that it was unprofitable due to his complacency about money and his business practices that were perceived, air quotes, as unprofessional, including making his bills out in crayon and writing poetry inside the furniture.
I thought you were going to say wearing clothes that were the same pattern as the furniture he upholstered.
That would be pretty awesome too.
Yeah. His fashion Camo. Sense is famously kind of shabby. Yeah. Oh, would people be, I guess in Detroit, camo couches wouldn't be like a stretch. I was thinking that would be something like here.
Well, if he was wearing the same upholstery as whatever, if he was wearing the same upholstery as whatever he just upholstered and he sat on it.
Oh, you're saying that works as camouflage. Oh, I thought you were saying the couches were camouflage. My brain is all over the place.
I would never disparage the South or our love of camo. He met Meg his senior year in high school. Well, she worked at a restaurant called Memphis Smoke, I believe. So kind of tying back to last week's discussion of talking about the real jobs that a band had before, you have a lead musician who was an upholsterer and then a drummer and vocalist who was a waitress at a restaurant. But
that sounds like a movie right there, I gotta say. That's like American Graffiti Part 2 or something.
There you go. Well, they ended up getting married in 1996, which answers the are they brother or sister question with they were married. And I know you've got some notes about that if we want to skip ahead to that a little bit.
Yeah, I don't really have a ton of notes. I always thought that that was a really dumb publicity stunt type thing. And more so because people didn't do any looking up about it. Mm-hmm. It was supposedly this mysterious thing. And I guess, I mean, this would have been before Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't necessarily know for sure, which maybe that kind of affects the way I think about it. But I always thought that was like such a lame thing, like just super pretentious. Like, oh, no, we're brother and sister. And also obviously very strange and creepy.
So I found a quote about this from an article interview that he did in 2005 for Rolling Stone. And they were married in 96. They were divorced in 2000. So a full 3 years before this album came out. So they stayed together in a band for, you know, a bunch of years after they got divorced. And so in his article interview, he says, when you see a band that is two pieces, husband and wife, boyfriend and girlfriend, you think, oh, I see. When they're brother and sister, you go, oh, that's interesting. You care more about the music, not the relationship, whether they're trying to save their relationship by being in a band. So that's his justification for it. But I'm going to agree with you. I think it's dumb and kitschy, but maybe a little bit better than saying we've been divorced for 4 years, but we're still working together.
It does create more mystique, I guess. I think of, like, when I think of married couples making music, I think of either the Carpenters, because they were married, right? Mm-hmm. That was, and then I
one
think
one of my mom's favorite bands, but I never got on board.
Okay. You know what? I can't remember her name, but the Lady Carpenter, the Carpentress, the Carpentress. She is a fantastic drummer. If you ever do yourself a favor after we get done recording and go look up on YouTube, look up her drumming because she is fantastic. And she, I think if I'm not mistaken, she like did percussion in school and stuff. So she can play like marimbas and like every percussion instrument under
the sun. That's pretty cool.
Unlike Meg White, who can
barely play the drums.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. We should go on to talking about how that is actually a bad take.
It is.
Because I when I was in high school, I kind of like, no, White Stripes, Meg White, which is dumb because I had barely heard any of their music. I just knew that Meg White played drums really simply. Mm-hmm. And so I complained about it like way too much. And like this whole album kind of has a keep it simple, stupid approach.
Yeah.
And I think her drumming is actually really great for what it is.
So I'm going to agree with you. I think especially when this album came out, it was really knocked around for kind of the overly basic tone and the overly basic drum playing, but it is so incredibly consistent throughout the album. Mm-hmm. And there is something to be said about consistent, equal playing, like even from start to finish of a song and from song to song, it just all fits together. So I agree. Mm-hmm. While it is basic and it's a basic drum kit, it's not like you're looking at 85 toms and 63 different cymbals and 8 different keys. Like it mm-hmm. is a very tight kit played simply. And I think one of the things that's a detractor from it is how overly ambient the recording is. Like it almost sounds like they put one microphone on the drum kit and just recorded it, and that's what you got. It's got a very garage sound to it, and that's one of the things that's driving people away from it.
See, I think that is kind of a dividing line for people when it comes to like kind of more independent music. Mm-hmm. Like, are you the kind of person who's going to scoff at a lo-fi recording, or do you enjoy that stuff because it's, you know, quote unquote raw or more real? Because a lot of the bands that they kind of take influence from, and just full disclosure, I'm not super versed in garage rock or like, you know, that kind of thing. But the bands I have listened to, like the Stooges and the Cramps, mm-hmm. like their records are super rough on the production end, but there's still a lot of attention to, I don't want to say attention to detail, but it's an aesthetic that they're going for. It's the same way that people kind of complain about Jackson Pollock paintings being just like a bunch of splatters on the canvas. But I mean, the guy had an approach and did certain things a certain way, you know, and for this record, it worked for me anyway, even though it was like, cause it did sound like they just tossed a mic up in a corner, or maybe they just like had two mics like in a room or something. But I really enjoyed that aspect of this album.
So I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it. I think that's one of the reasons people were detracted by it. Mm-hmm. I honestly, one of the notes that I wanted to talk about a little bit later was how much I admire Jack White for coming up with a vision and being fanatical about sticking to it. Like the guy is eccentric mm-hmm. as heck. He's all over the place. I mean, we've already talked about his fashion sense, but musically, just stylistically in general, he's just very eccentric. I mean, this is a guy who owns the earliest recording of Elvis Presley, some demo tape that was recorded in 1953, and the first Superman comic book, and some random guy's first driver's license. Like, just a very eccentric collector of things, including musical tones. And when he set out mm-hmm. to create this album in 2002, 2003, that was at the height of everybody going digital with everything. And he said, I'm going to create an album that is 100% analog. And by 100% analog, he meant reel-to-reel tape, no digital anything, period, on it. And so the liner notes for this album state that nothing was used to record this album that was produced later than 1963. He used an 8-track reel-to-reel recorder from like 1955 as the main recording bed for this project. And so he didn't have 28 tracks to mix drums down to in one, the way that he recorded this album. And I really admire when you're put in the box of using technology from 60 years before this in a lot of cases, and getting the kind of recording he got out of this, it's amazing. And it has a very distinct sound and a very distinct feel that is from the past. And on top of all of that, the thing that just kind of blows my mind is he recorded this entire album in 2 weeks plus 2 days. He didn't go sit in a studio like we've talked about Michael Jackson's creative process or Dave Grohl with the Foo Fighters, where they lock himself in a studio for 18 months and eke out an album somehow. This guy walked into a studio in, you know, basically 16 days and turned out something pretty stinking phenomenal using only equipment from the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, I think that speaks a lot to the conciseness of his vision and
coming prepared. Like, yeah, he knew exactly what he was going to do when he showed up.
Well, and to be honest, like, his music is, at least the music of this album, is not super complex. I think that it's a lot more attainable to just have you and your drummer show up and do drums and guitar and vocals. And I mean, he plays some keys and stuff. Like, he lays down, he runs his guitar through like an octave pedal so that he can get kind of a bass effect or whatever. So it's not as though he's just doing like three tracks and then he's done, but his music really lends itself well to that kind of an approach.
Yeah. That stripped down effect.
Yeah. You know, like Steely Dan would never show up to the studio and go like, all right, we've only got 2 weeks, let's do this thing. You know, like, their music is really comprehensively arranged and they have to bring in 7 guitarists to record one solo and stuff. But I think that is a mark of quality that him and Meg White had, like I said, a real concise vision and went, we know that this is what we're going to do. We know how it needs to sound. And they went and executed. And it, like, it sounds fantastic. I had kind of forgotten how, like, kind of charming that approach to his music could be.
Well, and really, something that I'm usually kind of down on is the overuse of effects. But because it is so stripped down and so, you know, there's 2 guitars and a bass line that's actually another guitar and a drum set and then a singer, the effects are kind of what sets the instruments apart, and they build on it, like almost to the effect that the pedal board he's using is its own instrument. And that's kind of a cool way of thinking about this music on its own.
Yeah. And the thing that is so brilliant about it too is, if you're thinking about it from the standpoint of somebody trying to produce a record, you're thinking about, like, how am I going to make all these frequencies line up, right? Like, if we have low frequencies in this instrument, we need to have an instrument with something complementary doing the highs or whatever. And the contrast between, like, the really deep kick drum and the, like, really kind of higher pitched sort of shrill guitar parts that he plays and the, like, real meaty fuzz tones of the guitar, like, they get away with only being 2 people because they've covered all their bases sonically. And I think that's another thing that kind of caught me by surprise, because another kind of detractor that I've always had in the back of my head about the White Stripes specifically is that there's not a bass player. And I am a fan of, like, a really good rhythm section. I think that that kind of makes or breaks a band. But, you know, that's another kind of keep it simple, stupid thing that Jack White uses as a workaround. You know, is he's using all these really big tones that have a lot of low end. And so the bottom doesn't really drop out of the recordings, even though I still kind of, like, I would love to hear a bassist in some of these songs just because that's my preference.
Yeah.
But it really is its own thing because his guitar playing covers such a, like, wide swatch of frequencies. And it's really cool. His playing is something that I think gets really overrated by a lot of people. You and I were kind of talking before the podcast that Jack White has, like, a really rabid fan base.
A cult fan base. Go ahead and say
it. They have like a cult fan base. Absolutely. But he does a lot of cool things. Like one of the things that I really noticed in this album is like he's kind of got a foot in two camps, right? Like I mentioned before, there's a lot of like punk influence from bands like the Stooges and the Cramps, but there's also a lot of like just straight ahead blues stuff, you know, and he's really leaned into the folk blues sound as he's done his solo.
I was going to say, since this band broke up in 2009, they've really, he's really focused on that blues folk thing, and he's actually really good at it. Like I enjoy his solo.
He's fantastic.
Work.
I found myself in such a weird space trying to think about this music this week because I'm kind of neither here nor there on his music most of the time, because you can't really deny his talent, but also it's just not always like it. It's a little repetitive to me sometimes because he uses a lot of the same kind of instruments and textures. He loves doubling up guitar parts with keyboards. And not just like playing the same thing, like an octave down or an octave up. He'll play a like unison part with the guitars. And he does that a lot in his music, which is fine. It just, a lot of his like production tendencies, like the big echoey drums, fuzzed out guitars, there's very little variation in it for me. And so I think this album, to bring it back around, this album is kind of an earlier iteration of that where it was fresh. And I really felt the like novel approach of it. I mean, even though this is their fourth album, right? Like it was still new and fun and felt like alive in a way that maybe some of his other stuff feels a little bit more intentional and kind of not stayed exactly, but it's been done. He's in his groove. Well, like it's not a new thing he's discovering.
Yeah. And this is obviously, at least to me, the height of the White Stripes, white stripiness. Like there were albums before this, and there was a couple of albums after this, but this is really the pinnacle of them being them. And because of that, they've got a comfort with who they are and what they are at that point in time. And I think that's one of the reasons it's so fresh, at least at the time.
And another thing I want to circle back to, because you said something, you brought up a reality that I like is like voiced in a little section of YouTube that I tend to live in, which is guitarists talking about their pedal board being an entire instrument unto itself, which is totally how a lot of people right now view their pedal boards, which is great. Like, because somebody like Jack White, or even somebody who's in like an ambient, like a noise rock band or something, that is a really entertaining approach. One of the first things I ever remember, like, hearing Jack White do, and he does it on this album that I really enjoy, is there's this guitar pedal called a Digitech Whammy. It's this giant red wah, you know, like for those of you who haven't seen, like if you've ever seen Jimi Hendrix use like a wah pedal, you know, it's got like a little treadle and you put your foot on it and move it back and forth. It's this big monstrosity of a pedal that's like fire engine red. And what it does is it takes your guitar tone, like whatever notes you're playing, and pushes them up however many octaves you've set the pedal. So that really kind of squealy, sort of bright sounding, fuzzed out guitar playing that sounds like real frenetic and crazy is from that pedal and that sound. You can also hear it on like Rage Against the Machine. Tom Morello does that a lot.
Soaring solo in Like a Stone went like...
And it's really just fantastic on this record. Like every time he does it, it's like to use my dumb phrase, it really is chef's kiss. Like, mwah. It's just perfect because it kind of is. It's another way that I think Jack White works around his limitations, because he's a really good guitarist. But he's not necessarily as technically gifted as probably a lot of the people he listens to. You know, there's a lot of Jimmy Page in his playing. But Jimmy Page was an extremely technical guitarist who, you know, played way up high on the tiny strings, as people like to say. And so to kind of get around having to be fleet fingered, he has this pedal that he just like launches into an octave above, and it's super cool. But like all the guitar tones in this album were really enjoyable to me, whether it was like, you know, like kind of a lower energy clean tone, or whether he was going like turning the dial up to 12 on whatever fuzz pedal he's using.
11, oh, 11,
and most of 11, these and then amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
It was texturally, it was really pleasing to listen to.
Listening to this album this week brought back to my mind when you were living in that little apartment and we watched Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I'd ever seen that movie, and it was years after it had come out. But that's one of those memories that the music from that movie and the music from this album are just kind of a perfect tie-in together.
Mm-hmm.
And it came rushing back to me. So I was thinking about that and just how cool that was.
Yeah, that's a fantastic movie. It's so much fun. I'm pretty sure I got rid of that DVD.
How?
Because I hadn't watched that movie in years. And so we went through a media purge and I was like, I don't need this. So I'm going to have to go out and buy it on Blu-ray or something.
I've got it in 4K on my media server and I just rewatched it like a month ago. So
I bet it looks fantastic in 4K because it's a real colorful movie.
Yeah,
it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And the sound is just phenomenal. Whatever they did to master it is perfect. But
yeah.
So that was that thing that came up. And then one of the other things that kind of was dredged up through my research of this album is something that I actually was familiar with from a few years ago that I wanted to bring up. And that's Jack White's philanthropy outside of music. The guy mm-hmm. has just done some amazing stuff for the city of Detroit and the state of Michigan as a whole in the years since becoming rich and famous. Like, he hasn't forgotten where he's from or what he's about. And for years, I believe she even still works there. His mom was an usher for the Detroit Masonic Temple, which, in addition to being like the home of Freemasonry in Detroit, is also a huge venue. It's a 16-story tall building that has three large theaters that hosts everything from like rock bands to theaters to ballets. All sorts of dining rooms and ballrooms and recital halls. And in 2013, the building was back on its taxes and it was about to be foreclosed. And Jack White paid off their tax bill and they renamed one of the theaters after him, their Black Box Theater that seats like 600 people. But one of the cool things about this building, it's a 16-story structure. It was built in the 1920s. And it's neo-Gothic in design and architecture, and it has a 6-story clear span cathedral in the middle of the building. So starting on like floor 7 and going up. So there's rooms above it and rooms below it. And in order to build a structure in the 20s that was capable of doing that, they had to just basically reinvent engineering. If you're going to do a cathedral, you do it on the top floor or the very bottom. And this one, just throwing it in the middle, it's a really cool marvel. And there's a cool video tour that's like an hour long on YouTube, kind of talking about the architecture of the building and the history of the building. And it talks a little bit about Jack White's saving the building from foreclosure and probably being torn down. But it's an absolutely gorgeous space.
I'm looking at pictures of the building on Google right now, and it is
phenomenal.
Astounding. That is a gorgeous building.
So
and the theater, the like Masonic Temple Theater inside it is just gorgeous.
Well, and the, every like, room in that building is gorgeous. They're hand painted, they're amazing. So
that is so great.
In
I like
in fear
when
of wearing
do,
it out, in fear of wearing out the phrase, Google it. You have to watch, if you've got the time, watch the YouTube video that is the tour of the Masonic. It's very Freemasonry focused because it's a tour for Freemasons, but they talk about all the history of the building, and like there's these two giant chandeliers in the main room, the main theater, that in order to change the light bulbs, they actually lower the chandeliers to the ground. And a couple of years ago, for the first time in like 50 years, they lowered them, and it took like 2 days to lower them by hand, like with a hand crank.
That's incredible. I love it.
But they talk about all that stuff. It's awesome.
I need to check out that video. That's amazing. I like that he has kind of a sense of like
home.
A sense of home, and kind of, you know, Detroit is one of those cities that has had it so rough for so long.
And people love to hate on it. I mean, it's the butt of most jokes.
You know what? I would make a joke about their baseball team, but
which Jack White is a huge fan of, so don't say anything bad about the Tigers.
Well, I can't now because they beat the trash out of the Royals in their most recent series. Do you want to go on to the critical reception?
Yeah, man, let's do it. So, Chris, my favorite portion of critical receptions is when we talk about Metacritic, and this album scored a 92. So that's got to be some kind of record for our show, like the highest score I think we've ever talked about.
It's got to be. Yeah. When I was doing the research, I was like, man, most of them are like upper 60s, lower 70s. And maybe occasionally we stray into like 80s territory. Mm-hmm. But 92 is, that's a lot of people going, yeah, I love this.
Yeah, definitely. And one of your notes in here is that it made the 500 greatest albums of all time by Rolling Stones.
Uh-huh. But it landed at 390. That 500 greatest albums of all time is really funny to me because, like, does it mean anything if you aren't in the first 100? Like, I feel like that sample size is so, like, it just borders on being meaningless.
Well, to build on another Rolling Stone list, it was considered the number 6th album of the decade. And Seven Nation Army was the 3rd-ranked song of the decade. So,
oh man, okay, so they're just killing it in the Rolling Stones' eyes, which that's like kind of a baseline for most people is Rolling Stone. But still, I mean, you're going to take a claim where you can get it. Also, I wanted to point out about Seven Nation Army. I think that has become the stairway to heaven for bassists.
And there's not even a bass guitar in it, which is awesome.
I know, but bassists always sit down and play that. If you go in a Guitar Center or whatever, you'll hear, dum, 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 dum. We played that in band in the stands.
Yep.
In high school. That song went everywhere. It was funny to read reviews. I didn't pull any quotes from the NME publication because they weren't really saying anything that these other two reviews I'm about to talk about say, but it was funny to hear people talking about it from the time when it was released, not knowing that Seven Nation Army was going to be played at sporting events like around
years later.
Yeah, exactly. It was so funny. And actually the NME part article popped up in the Wayback Machine. When I followed the Wikipedia link, it opened up to the Wayback Machine is how nice. Old that webpage was. But anyway, to look at actual like critical reviews, Brent DiCrescenzo, who has probably my favorite name of any reviewers we've talked about so far, from Pitchfork, he gave this album a 6.9. And he said, the problem is that Jack White aims to honor his diverse heroes with too limited a palette. It's like paying tribute to Edward Hopper, Ansel Adams, Robert Colescott, and Georgia O'Keeffe in a mural with foot pump operated Wagner power painter and buckets of red and white. And I thought it was interesting that he thought that their like disparate influences didn't work, because I kind of think what Jack White has done, one of the reasons I actually kind of like his music whenever I'm in the mood for it, is that that lo-fi rock and roll aesthetic is part of the punk tradition and is an aesthetic that is inherent to a lot of old blues stuff. Even if you go back to like Robert Johnson, it's just a guy in a room with his guitar playing.
Well, not to interrupt you, but
no, please
the
do.
Thing that I really admire about his style is how pure of rock and roll is a guy that's just doing his thing.
Yeah.
And regardless of what the influences of that thing are, you get a feeling of this is me. And if you don't like it, get over it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's definitely the attitude that he presents. It is very rock and roll. And I think kind of a more cynical read of his music would suggest that a lot of that is put on, and maybe it's something that he thinks about a lot, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's not something true to him. Mm-hmm. You know, I think when I'm not in the mood for his music, it's because I interpret it as being a little try hard and maybe like a little too cool for school. But with this album anyway, I really did enjoy it because he's got kind of a foot in both those camps, like I was saying, and like this Pitchfork writer said. But the other review that I pulled was just like, rah, rah, this album is amazing. David Frick of Rolling Stone gave this album 5 out of 5 stars. And I was unable to actually read the review because I've hit my like limit of free articles. I kept trying to like see if there was somewhere I could click to navigate away from the paywall, but I ran hard up against the paywall. But I will quote Wikipedia quoting David Frick's review. He calls it a pulverizing work of perfection and calls it one of the best things you'll hear all year. You'll hear all year. That's a vocal warm up. But like he mentions that it's pulverizing, and boy, like that's one of the things I love about this album is the riffs are so heavy, and combined with just the like the huge bass drum kick and the like punch of the snare from Meg White, like this album really does kind of thunder along. It's very rock and roll.
So I have a pair of Adam A7S studio monitors that are like reference grade recording and mastering album monitors. And this is an album that I turned up earlier this week just because I wanted to hear what it sounded like with some serious volume without like hurting my ears. And the thing that stuck with me is just how much it punches you in the heart.
Like, there is so much
sonic value to this album that it is pulverizing. Like you feel it in your chest and it's awesome. Like I felt great about this album when I was listening to it.
Yeah, it really was a lot of fun.
Well, and then the final review I want to bring up is our boy, Robert Christgau, who has my favorite last name in the history of our reviews, originally gave this a mediocre rating at 3 stars. And later, a couple of years later, revised it saying he was too critical and that it was an A-minus effort. I'm going to point out he used 2 different grading scales so that you couldn't really contradict yourself.
Hey, that's, you got to use the same units, man. He's covering his rear. That's the way to be, Robert.
But as far as the industry is concerned, in addition to a 92 Metacritic, this album won 2 Grammys. And that's a pretty good haul for a guy that was just making garage rock, essentially.
Now, here's the question. Which Grammys did it win? I'm looking that up right now.
So the 2004 Grammys, Elephant, the album, won Best Alternative Album, and Seven Nation Army won Best Rock Performance.
That's fantastic. You know what? Speaking of Seven Nation Army, do you remember the music video?
Oh, it's so good.
For Seven Nation Army. It's so fun. The camera just constantly pushing into the bass, the kick drum.
Yep.
And then it's like another image and it just keeps like zooming in and zooming in. There was a band called Fall of Troy. They were like a post-punk, like hardcore group. And they had a song called FCP Remix. And their video for that was like a huge ripoff of that White Stripes video. Look it up and compare those two, listeners, because it's really pretty funny.
Something we didn't talk about in the body of this interview or this podcast, but it's coming back to me now, is a lot of people dumped on their monochromatic like color schemes in like their art.
I was one of those people.
I love it. Sorry. Like, that's just simple. Like, in the what brought that back to my mind was the music videos that way. And it's just clean and tight. I love it. So get over it.
I definitely see why people like it. I just, some of those affectation-y kind of things rub me the wrong way. And I don't have a good reason for it, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just a codger. I'm 31 years old and I'm already a contrarian codger. So let that be a warning to you 29-year-olds. If you think you're young, just give it a couple of years. You're going to get old quick. Well, that's those are all the critical reviews. Do you want to jump into our reviews?
Yeah, and just to remind all of our listeners, we rate our albums on a scale of 1 to 6 guitar strings, 1 string describing a miserable, execrable hour of music, and 6 strings describing an album that moved you to tears in public or called to your spirit in a way that few things can. Chris wrote that line, beautiful. And I think it's beautiful.
Thank you so much. I didn't know you were going to give me credit. Otherwise, I wouldn't have said it was beautiful.
What did you think about this album, Chris?
Oh, man. Now I sound like a real jerk and an old codger. So, look, like I've mentioned before, my opinion of Jack White's body of work tends to kind of fluctuate based on what mood I'm in. And a lot of times lately, it's been just rolling my eyes at the whole ragamuffin thrift store aesthetic that he is kind of like married to at this point. I think he's a little repetitive, and I think that a lot of people kind of overrate his playing. Mm-hmm. But honestly, dude, like this time I had a whole lot of fun listening to this music. I really like his commitment to the lo-fi old school approach. I really like his, something I didn't get to mention is that he likes to wrestle inspiring tones out of busted or bad guitars. Like if you've ever seen the documentary It Might Get Loud, I think it opens with him nailing a little strip of metal and a guitar string to a board and hooking up a pickup to it and playing it as like a slide guitar. And that whole aesthetic and that way of making music is all over this album. And I think that is this album's biggest strength. You know, they're at their best when they're doing this kind of thing. And like I mentioned before, I'm not a huge fan of bands that don't have bass players. I was in a band that was just me and a drummer for a while. And I got so fed up with not having a bassist. But, you know, Jack and Meg White really make it work. It contains enough punk to give this album street cred and enough blues guitar to keep the guitarist in me interested. And like I said earlier, I've even kind of come around to Meg White's overly simplistic drumming. You know, it might be ham-fisted and repetitive, but boy, it just works for this album. And so I'm giving this album 4 out of 6 strings. But that's not like a critical low ranking 4. It's a good 4 strings. It wasn't my favorite album of all time. But it was good. I really enjoyed it. And maybe those 4 strings can go towards getting a bassist for the White Stripes. What did you think of this album?
Well, 2 things before I get into my review. First, there is a really interesting article on the instruments of Jack White that I read this week that we didn't get to talk about. Mm-hmm. And everything from cheap guitars to, you know, the way he's been able to get sounds out of, you know, a board with a guitar string taped to it, literally. It's awesome. So if you have the time to go look at an eccentric person's take on what a good instrument is and what you can get out of it, he's definitely getting the most out of the least.
You need to send me that link because that like he really is kind of a MacGyver of instruments. And I love that about him. And I had forgotten that until we did this episode this week.
So when it comes time to put a string count on this album, this week was kind of hard for me to separate myself from it. Cause when I went into this album, I was like, I'm giving this 6 strings just because of how awesome my experience with this album has been.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been probably 10 years since I'd listened to this album start to finish. And there are things about it that really bug me. Nothing that I hate, nothing that I feel is like a sin beyond belief and it has to be thrown out. But it obviously, as time has worn on, it does not warrant six strings to me anymore. Mm-hmm. And I jokingly thought that I was going to make a review that said, I'm giving this six strings and I'm going to drown you out in fuzz pedals, your descent. But that's not the reality of it. This album is incredibly raw in its sound, and I really like that about it. I like the fact that it sounds like it was recorded in the 60s with modern musical sensibilities. At this time, it's a very rare sound. As a society, we are so focused on the now, technologically speaking, the newest iPhone, the newest recording interface, and I find myself caught up in that as we produce this show. And I remember a huge amount of press about this album and the fact that there were no computers used in the creation of it. White has famously said that there were no computers even used in the writing of the album. So when he was researching it or, you know, creating the music for it, he was just sitting there with a guitar and making it happen on paper. And that's really cool. The fact that this is just a blast from the past, technologically speaking. I freely admit that my love for that aspect colors my review. I have a soft spot for art that is aware of its genesis, that understands where it comes from and where it's trying to go. And I feel like Jack White, despite all of his weirdness and his cult following, has a clear understanding of his context and where he fits in the musical timeline. And this album ends up being a keeper. It may not be innovative. It may not be something that changed the way we think about rock for forever, but it has its spot and it belongs. We've talked about the creative process of Dave Grohl and the Foo Fighters and Michael Jackson and all of their propensities to lock themselves away. And here's a guy who worked on something and produced it quickly and managed to make something that we still like 15, 20 years later. So it deserves its space in the pantheon of great rock. And I'm going to agree with you. I think it's a high-end four-string album, kind of moving on. It's something that I will enjoy for years to come. And you can take that to the bank and cash it for diamonds from a stolen Antwerp heist.
Hopefully it's $11 million worth of diamonds or whatever.
$100
million. $100 million. $100 million diamonds. what am I thinking? Is that Austin Powers?
$1 billion. Yes.
Yes. Okay. You read my mind. I haven't even seen that movie and I like had that dumb line stuck in my head. All right. So we've given this thing its due. Do you want to talk about favorite and least favorite track, or do you want me to go?
I want you to talk about your favorite track first.
Okay. So I'm going to mention the runner-up, and I brought it up to you before we started recording because I had this song stuck in my head most of this week. It's a cover. Jack White. It's the White Stripes. I keep leaving Meg out of the picture, and it's Jack White and Meg White as the White Stripes. So,
which
it's
side their note. Side note: when they got married, he took her last name. His last name is Gillis. So, you know. Anyhow, go ahead.
Yeah, but nobody is interested in Jack Gillis. Everybody wants to hear about Jack White.
Jack Gillis sounds like a CIA cover name for like witness protection.
That's for sure a character in like Hunt for Red October. What is that author's name? Tom Clancy. Jack Gillis is definitely a Tom Clancy character. But anyway, this is the like tangent episode. But one of my favorite songs was I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself. Because it's a really good cover. Like the original is so, but Jack White brings, you know, Jack White and Meg White bring the thunder on that tune. It's really loud and raucous. But my favorite tune on the album was Ball and Biscuit. The structure of that song is really close to like a true blues tune as far as like the amount of bars that each chord gets and the repetition of Jack White's lyrics. It's a straight up old school blues tune. He's just kind of slapped his aesthetic on it. You know, nobody's going to mistake Jack White for Robert Johnson, but his take on the blues is fun. And like I said before, Meg White's really stompy, ham-fisted drumming is fun. And especially in this tune, it really works. This tune also features Jack White's kind of frenetic, oversaturated, high gain fuzz tone with the like Digitech whammy all over the place. Like it's really cool. That was my favorite song. Which one? Oh, you know what? I know why you wanted me to do that, because your favorite song and my least favorite song dovetail a little bit.
Yeah, they do. So I'm going to talk about my least favorite first, and then we can go back and forth on. This is the second time my favorite has been your least favorite. I'm going to point that out. So
yeah, we still don't have a name for that either. We need to figure that out.
So my least favorite song on this album is the last song on this album, and I seem to have a running hate for final songs on albums. It seems like three or four times in the 18 episodes so far, the final song has been the one that draws my ire. And for this album, that's well, it's true that we love one another. This is kind of it's the two of them singing a duet. It's acoustic. It features a tambourine. And I feel like tambourines are just this evil anti-musician instrument. And maybe that's just a holdover from my youth growing up in the Church of Christ, where we sang a cappella music. And on Wednesday, to prove that we were cool and not following the rules, the music leader would bring out a tambourine and play it off key and off time. And it just sucked.
A tambourine.
I hate tambourines. Oh, man. Like, we don't need such that touch of modernity in our life. Burn them to the ground. So I really just did not like this song. It's not even that good of a song, like lyrically, like cutting out the tambourine. I just did not like this song. So
yeah. Oh, yeah. Well. So something I was reading is there are actually three people singing that song. It's two different ladies singing and Jack White. And it's got kind of a coy, like Shakespeare level of innuendo.
Oh yeah.
The three people singing. I was not a fan of that either, but I also kind of ignored it.
It fed into the hype of brother, sister, husband, wife, maybe both kind of thing. And it just, it doesn't work in any way. Like, okay, whatever. That's now fair. For my favorite song, what was your least favorite song? I get the last word, since it's my favorite. So
hey, it's your episode. You get the last word. So my least favorite song, which was your favorite, was In the Cold, Cold Night. And not necessarily because it is like a terrible song, but it squanders all of its potential. Mm-hmm. That song really doesn't go anywhere. There's not like a real big peak to the song. It just kind of hangs out in the valley. Mm-hmm. And I like the guitar part. Like, it kind of caught my ear when I was listening to it for the first time, but it didn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it was the only song that Meg White got to sing. And it kind of disappointed me that it didn't go anywhere. And it's actually kind of funny. When I was listening to it this morning, taking my wife to work, I skipped the song and she was like, "Man, that song was boring." And I was like, "Yeah, it really is." But this was your favorite song, so you get the last word. Why am I wrong? Tell me.
So I picked In the Cold, Cold Night as my favorite song, partially because it's the solo from Meg White. I think her voice is exceptional. She has a quality to her voice that's just kind of captivating to me acoustically. It's the most stripped down of an entire album of stripped down songs. I feel like the least produced of all the songs on this album, which is saying something, because I did not think any of the songs was overproduced on this album.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the reason why I think it was, and why I've returned to it over the years as kind of my favorite song on this album, is the fact that it does go nowhere because it's a song about being alone, about being kind of in mourning of a relationship lost, the lyrics kind of circle around the idea of being on a corner alone, being in a kitchen alone, and when you're gone from me, I'm cold, cold, cold. It's in the cold, cold night. And it kind of has this imagery. We've all heard the stories about, you know, the old couple who have been married for 40 years and one of them passes away and the other one never gets over it. Or the younger couple where somebody passes away early and they live the rest of their life as a single person and always kind of lament the fact that they didn't get to grow old with that person that they loved. And what I really like about this song is it doesn't just hit you over the head with the imagery of loss and, oh, I'm so alone and I feel so lonely. It uses the terminology in the cold, cold night to paint the picture of being alone. Like there's nobody to help me stay warm at night anymore. And that just kind of lights up in my heart just something that I think just connects with me. It is easily the most depressing song on this album.
Yeah, which is funny because you hate depressing stuff and you're over here loving this like unrequited love this like loss of love in this relationship. That's funny.
But anyhow, so that's the reason that I really like this one. And I really hate the fact that after the White Stripes broke up, Meg White stopped being in the music industry. She hasn't done anything since they broke up. She had a panic attack in some sort of performance, I think in 2009, and really hasn't toured or performed since then. And when you look her up on Wikipedia, she's described as a former musician, former songwriter, and former singer. And so
that is too bad because I enjoyed her voice. Her voice had nothing to do with why I didn't like that song.
But anyhow, that was my favorite track. And, despite you saying it goes nowhere, I feel like that's the reason that I like it. So, because you're not moving on from that lost love. So,
yeah, that's fair. It's a good read of that song.
So that's it, Chris. We have been held back by No Seven Nation Army. Let's talk about the Oracle and where she's going to send us this week. Number 10, which from your list is Herbie Hancock's Headhunters, 1973.
All right.
Taking it old school, man.
Taking it old school, taking it some jazz and funk fusion, and also a super short album. There are only four tracks on Herbie Hancock's Headhunters. So we will be in for a little bit of a challenge next week, I think.
Awesome. Well, folks, thank you so much for listening. If you've been enjoying our show, please rate and review it. You might even get your comments read on the air.
Yeah, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, shoot us an email at twodudesandtunes@gmail.com. And don't forget to hit us up on Instagram or Facebook as well. Let us know what you thought of this episode, and let us know what you thought of the album Elephant. And don't forget to tune in next Wednesday where we hunt heads and get funky with the king of keyboards himself, Herbie Hancock. Y'all take care.